Great, thank you so much. I wanted to open it up for Q&A with the audience. I ask that we please keep it respectful and please have your questions be on topic, kind of about the future of New Bedford's fishing industry. And also only take the microphone if you have a question and not a statement. So with that said, who has questions?
Very similar to New
Sorry,
Bedford.
Would you mind repeating the question just so that way everyone...
He asked how Gloucester was different from New Bedford, how they fish, and if it's similar to New Bedford. It's similar to New Bedford. It's a lot of ground fishermen, but unlike New Bedford, they have not been able to sustain themselves, and it's a lot of smaller vessels. So they, once catch shares came in, a lot of people sold their vessels and their permits, and so it's definitely, I would say, a ghost town now compared to New Bedford. Right?
Gloucester is specialized in ground fish.
So they don't have scallops, so I think that's why you're not
seeing
as much activity.
And they specialized in one fishery.
The question was, how much does Sector 9
no,
owe?
No, we're not going to share that at this time.
The question was, what can be done about choke species?
And
also, what
quota?
Are choke species?
I think you have, say, like yellowtail flounder, and it's swimming with things like haddock. If yellowtail's a choke species, that's what's preventing you from landing more haddock. So the only real solution to that is raising the quota, which is... science-based. There's other ways. I mean,
then how do you balance the needs of the fishermen against, I guess, a perceived concern?
It's a really great question.
I'll say it, something. There's never been a history of ocean species going extinct. There's lake species that have gone extinct. So that I'm not saying that we should fish down anything so there's a danger of that or a danger of switching in terms of species in their environment. But, Sidney Holt, who is the founder of Stock Assessment, came to New England and spoke in Boston. And he was astonishing to me because he said that we pay so much close attention to this overfishing. We're going over a little bit. Going over the quota a little bit would cause a very large benefit. So it really comes down to benefit cost in my mind. So we're not going to drive a species to extinction, I don't think. We haven't yet. But it's a possibility. And I know somebody, a biologist, told me, never say the word extinct, the air goes out of the room. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to talk about that, really. But I think we have to be a little bit more flexible about some of these species. And we have to look at what the fishermen are telling us, which doesn't really happen in the system. Fishermen give testimony at various meetings, but they're really not part of the process, except in scallops, where they really are part of the process, because it's a multi-billion-dollar business.
I was just saying, I think that they would dispute the levels of yellowtail, what the models are saying. When I was on the council, it was so interesting because we had, as fully fish people, we had seen all these landings of yellowtail, and even Friendly's was having yellowtail on their menus. And then all of a sudden, when I got on the council, they said, oh my gosh, we were so wrong. There's a retrospective pattern, and there must have been however many tens of thousands of pounds of discards we didn't realize. And none of it made sense. It was definitely, there was an error in the model. So was it right when they were super abundant, or was it right when they were super scarce? We're not sure. But to hamstring every other fishery in science that was completely questionable and had really seesawed demanded more research, more due diligence before you made the adjustments that were made, in my opinion.
Yeah, just to add, I mean, this is one of the problems with the single species management. This is a movement towards ecosystem-based fisheries management where you're managing the biomass, not each individual species. So there's a lot of work being done on that, and maybe at some point that's the way to do it. So it doesn't matter how many yellowtail you catch or how many windowpane flounder, it's what the overall biomass is. It's we have an ecosystem-based fisheries management. We've got a committee that's been working on that, right? So it's, but that may be, there's a lot of advocates for that. But the extreme example is the scallops and yellowtail and cod and haddock, that they're choking off access to very valuable species. And is there a market even now for yellowtail?
No.
Right, no market for yellowtail. And the scallop industry basically is $1 billion a year in New Bedford when you put in the multiplier. So that's why there may be this movement towards the ecosystem-based fisheries management.
I don't think there's any progress.
I don't think there's enough being done.
Could everyone hear the question?
Oh, sorry,
what was asked? The question was, what's the progress in limiting the amount of foreign fish coming in into the United States? Was that
from countries that
aren't managed the way that we're managed? What's the process of limiting that?
Yeah, I mean, that's an issue that is sort of at the government level, setting tariffs and regulations. And because you do have countries that don't have size restrictions, and if you travel and see at markets, tiny swordfish being landed. And, you know, a few years ago, just to be aware of things that are out there that you think seem like such a good idea, there was a whole Give Swordfish a Break campaign, and the chefs got together and said, oh, we shouldn't put swordfish on the menu. We should definitely boycott swordfish. Well, the U.S., it's a global quota because of it's a highly migratory species that swims the globe. The U.S. fishermen are at the forefront of fishery management measures, gear modifications to not interact with sea turtles. And they underfish their quota by 250,000 pounds a year. Well, when they underfish that quota, then that quota becomes fair game for the countries that are harvesting the small fish or not doing the gear modification. So I just caution everyone to be very careful when these sort of well-intended PR campaigns come through, because often the law of unintended consequences come and you end up punishing the people who are actually doing the right thing.
I think it's an interesting question. I know a little bit about shrimp. Most shrimp comes from Southeast Asia, and it's really not environmental managed in any way. In fact, there's some evidence of slavery in those fisheries, and people eat shrimp, right? So people buy based on price and what they like to eat. And it's just the way it is. I don't know of anybody. I think it's really, really difficult to make a profit saying, you know, our fish is better quality, but it's higher priced. It's just really a tough, tough game. There's some beginnings of that, but it's a tough, tough game to say we're charging a higher price because our fish is environmentally friendly. No matter what we all say about environmentally friendly, we buy stuff based on price.
I recently got involved in the fishing industry. I've been working on one of the smallest ground fishing boats in the region for the last 6 months. I've been on 6 or 7 trips. I don't know much about quotas. I guess my question is, let me give you an example. We catch, one of the best fish we catch are the halibut. You know, they're this big. And if we get one, we're very lucky because it's a good chunk of money. The quota for our trip is one halibut. They travel in pairs. I've never hauled in one halibut without a second one in the net. Guess what happens to the second one? So I guess my question is, who's making these decisions? Like, that's just one silly example to me. And I consider myself a very liberal person. I definitely consider myself environmental and college educated. But a lot of this stuff just really doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever. So who's making these decisions about individual limits?
I'll speak to that. There's a huge amount of research and data showing that trip limits are ineffective. They kill fish because people throw away the smaller stuff even after they're caught, and you know, it's hard to recover from being caught or being whatever it's done to the fish. So and it's well known. And the halibut fishery is interesting because Canada's halibut fishery is very large scale and sustainable. Our halibut fishery is neither. And the SSC looked at that. The committee I'm on looked at that and recommended more. Somebody look at how the management came about to catch one halibut per trip, because I saw some. I read the data. My memory's terrible, but I think something like 30% or 40% are discarded. That's what they think, and it's probably higher than that. So I think it was just you know, halibut sort of fell off the table a bit in terms of the focus on it. There's more focus now on halibut. I mean, I think there should never be a trip limit on anything because it's really ineffective, and it kills fish without eating it. I'm an economist. I like to see fish die because they're going to be eaten. I don't like to see them die because they're going to be tossed overboard. And the whole halibut system encourages throwing halibut overboard.
40 to 60% go back overboard dead.
No. Yep.
It's silly.
There's some movement on that.
Yes.
But everything takes time.
So there is, there has been discussion of doing an assessment. So the reason why it went down to one fish is because it was severely overfished prior to the Sustainable Fisheries Act going in, preventing, outlawing overfishing. But there is conversation because there are so many halibut in Canada, and believe it or not, the fish don't know what country they're swimming in. So they and all that fish comes in to the U.S., and so they're saying, you know what, we're seeing fish in our own waters much more than, you know, we had prior, anecdotally through the fishermen. So there are discussions about having a formal assessment of the stock so that they could potentially set an ACL for halibut as opposed to doing the trip limit. I think it's sort of like ocean catfish. They said no, you know, zero possession limit. And again, if you get it in your net, then it ends up, you know, a dead discard basically. So it comes from sort of the most punitive when people are in crisis mode about the health of a stock.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Many people are concerned about the social impacts of the rules and regulations in the brown fish fishery, as one example. Can any of you comment on what you observe regarding the impacts on fishing families? With their lives involved. This is not just about economics. It's about what happens to people. So can you share something?
And I was actually talking earlier about this, and I had a fear that with the shutdown of the majority of the fleet in New Bedford for groundfish, you would see a lot of people going back to Maine, which sounds funny, but a lot of ground fishermen are from Maine, so they're here and they're working out of New Bedford, and I don't know if we're going to get those people back. So that's a big fear I think I have. And it's more about that a lot of the ground fishermen are older, so when you eliminate them from a fishery, who's going to teach the next generation? I think that's our biggest problem with scallops. You have younger guys, they want to make money, so they're going to go fishing and they're going to learn. But with ground fishermen, you're losing that. I mean, the captain's the teacher, and the classroom is the wheelhouse, so you need them fishing and you want them to teach younger people. And so I think that's my greatest fear. I think you're going to lose a lot of that next generation of ground fishermen, so a lot of families. I mean, most of the families I know are scallopers at this point that have captains and mates, and the mates are their sons. So
I do want to jump in. It's not necessarily an answer to your question, but just tonight was about one fisherman that didn't play by the rules. And I just like to say there are a lot of amazing fishermen in the fishery that are playing by the rules and are reinvesting in the fishery. And I was on the boat of a fisherman who actually broke his boat in half so that he could add more to the size of his vessel and put special flake ice in, put a special gutting machine on board. He did research in Nova Scotia on net techniques. This gentleman has an eighth grade education, and he is reinvesting in his fishing boats to make sure that he is bringing the very best, highest quality product to port that can then be distributed throughout the United States. So there are great fishermen in the fishery playing by the rules, doing the right thing. So I just wanted to make that clear because that hadn't really come out in our conversation.
I just want to add one tagline to that as far as the infrastructure. That boat owner is from Maine and got his work done in the Fairhaven shipyard in Fairhaven. So, you know, this is not just a southeastern Massachusetts port. It's a big infrastructure area.
There was a change in the law that was harmful, particularly to this point. Originally, the law was written in terms of optimum yield. The definition of optimum yield said something like social and economic concerns could be considered in setting optimum yield. Now the law says can only reduce optimum yield. Social and economic considerations can only reduce optimum yield. So the whole sense of fishing communities and the effect on fishing communities has been nullified by that one word change in the law.
And there is a limit.
The question was, should there be a limit on how many permits each individual should be able to hold?
So I believe the limit's 5% per one owner. And so if you're looking at someone like Carlos, he didn't even come close to that 5%. So
is that the limit effective then?
Is the limit effective?
I mean,
should it be a smaller limit, I guess, is the question?
I don't think
so. Debated that a few years ago at the council level and passed Amendment 18, which put a 5% cap. I think there's about 1,300 fishing permits out, so it was 5% on that. There's also this horribly complicated, and I'm just going to give you the phrase because I can't understand it or explain it, is potential sector contribution, which is another cap, how much fish that someone can contribute. There's also a cap on that. On the scallop side, there's a 5%. The most scallop permits that one entity can own are 17. There are several people that own 17. Several of them are not from New Bedford as well. So keep that in mind when we talk about the catch shares going to the scallop industry.
We have time for one more question.
I heard several positive comments about how Canadians manage fisheries. Is there any sort of form of cooperation between our fisheries regulation here and what Canadians do, and do we learn from each other?
I was using an example of the Canadian fisheries in haddock, but don't forget that the Canadian fishery management system wiped out George's Bank cod, the greatest fishery in the world. So we have to go easy on praising Canadian fishery management. I think there is some information going back and forth. Canada is a very top-down system. We have a democratic sort of up system, which is less efficient in a sense of how quickly it can react. But I think there's lessons to be learned on both sides. But Canada had its problems. And in fact, the elimination of the Grand Banks cod had a huge psychic effect, I think, on fishery biologists. Nobody wants to be blamed for wiping out that kind of a fishery. So it added this sort of sense of worry that we can't go a little bit over because we're going to wipe out the stock.
We do negotiate with them, too, every year on shared stocks. So it's called the TRAC, I think.
Yeah, we meet annually. I'm part of that negotiating team. We negotiate the species out near the Canadian line. Our scientists talk regularly with the scientists. There's all these acronyms, so forgive me. It's a TMGC. We alternate. We go up there every other year, and they come down here. So there's cooperation between the two.
The biggest thing, I think, for them being able to harvest haddock, as I understand from the boat owner I was discussing earlier who does a lot of study in Canada, is mesh size. So they have a larger mesh size than we have. So the haddock biomass is maturing at a smaller size because it is the largest biomass pulsing through the system. And so they, prior we had a 21-inch limit, so we were discarding a bunch of fish. We have now gone to 19 inches because Woods Hole determined them to be sexually mature fish that we could take out of the ocean. We weren't taking the babies. But the Canadians had been harvesting that 19-inch fish for years ahead of us because they did have the larger mesh size than we allow here in the U.S.
They also fish right on the U.S. border?
Yes, they do.
And they fish right next to an area that's closed to U.S. fishermen? So any increase in the stock that spills over into Canada, they don't know where they're going, is caught by Canadian vessels. And the U.S. ground fish boats can't fish on this side, our side of the border.